We really wanted to have the doctors and the patients to have a lot more incentive to be judicious in how they spend money. And we could absolutely give every patient enough money to get world-class care and outcomes, but we didn't want to waste money anymore.
Physician, consultant, policymaker, VC. Bob Kocher understands healthcare better than most. Will this knowledge be enough to enable him to improve a deeply troubled system?
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
Some of us grow up wanting to be baseball players, or singers, or actors, or video game designers. Bob Kocher, as I understand it, wanted to run a hospital when he grew up, but instead he designed a healthcare system. Bob double majored in zoology and political science at the University of Washington, the fourth generation of his family to attend the school. After med school and residency, he joined McKinsey, where he focused on understanding the high cost of U.S. healthcare. He subsequently got to apply this expertise as a special advisor to President Obama and was one of just two physicians, the other was Zeke Emanuel, to craft the Affordable Care Act. He subsequently joined Venrock's Silicon Valley office, where he now focuses on health IT, healthcare services, and digital health, and has invested in companies such as Grand Rounds and Doctors on Demand. We're both so excited he's here today on our podcast. Welcome, Bob.
Good morning.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
I'm great. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. So you and I share this upbringing in political science, which obviously leads to venture capital, it appears. How did that happen? How did you get from where you started wanting to run a hospital to where you are now? Was it intentional? Was this your grand scheme?
Oh, I wish it, you know, in hindsight, I wish I could say it was. But no, it was a series of serendipitous happenings. I started out actually studying squirrel hibernation.
Squirrel hibernation.
So my zoology focus was how squirrels sleep, which means that you can go visit.
Do they sleep well? Do squirrels sleep well?
Apparently. And so it actually started out by getting to visit ski areas and dig up squirrels.
Wow.
And then go skiing.
Well, dig up dead squirrels?
No, they're sleeping.
Oh, okay.
They're just resting, Lisa. Yeah.
Just resting.
Unfortunately, there is no job and career path for that.
Yeah.
And so that led me to think about other things. And so I went to medical school.
Well, but you were interested. You also studied, I thought, game theory, and were really interested even in economics, even in college.
Yeah, so
where did that all come
when
from?
I was in college, they hadn't invented the term behavioral economics yet, I think. And so we called it game theory, and it was kind of Cold War political science, you know, and trying to map out, like, what will happen with Cuba and Russia.
Or squirrels, as the case may be.
Well, but those are really different interests. Did you always sort of have... You know, were you trying to figure out what you wanted to do? I mean, how do you even go from even biology and economics to sort of med school and hospitals?
I think a theme might be that I like learning and I'm driven by passion. And so, you know, I was very interested in the science. And so zoology and biochemistry and cell biology were, you know, fascinating to me for how things work. And equally fascinating to me was, you know, how does the world work and how do people make decisions? And trying to understand that was, you know, equally engaging to me.
Was there a class you had on game theory that particularly stands out or some experience?
I did have a great class as an undergrad from a professor who kind of like in the stand and deliver sort of, you know, stood on the tables and, you know, broke us into groups and had us, you know, basically fighting out the Cold War over 12 weeks.
Live action Risk.
And it was like sort of before we could gamify, but he did, where every week he'd give us a twist or a new constraint. You'd have to try to solve out what would happen. And you were graded on how effectively you sort of responded to the externalities that he interjected into the class. And it made me realize that was a lot like how life works, which is, you know, being adaptive quickly and thinking through sort of multi-steps. And that's come back to be very helpful later. At the time, it wasn't exactly clear how it all fit together. And I'd say in my career, I've been mainly guided by finding good mentors, people that were great that I could learn from and sort of not too picky about what they were good at. And that's how I've learned.
What's the one that really stands out to you? What did they teach you?
Oh, I've had many. Mm-hmm. Maybe the first one was a researcher named John Hammer at the NIH. He's in the Heart-Lung and Blood Institute. And I left medical school and went to do research there for a year as a Howard Hughes fellow. And he taught me sort of the hard part of wet science and the level of thinking you had to have to actually do an experiment when you didn't have, you know, necessarily all the tools we had today, but to understand basic questions in biology. And I remember early in my tenure at NIH doing, you know, a cell biology experiment where we were measuring how fast proteins moved in cells. And we thought we'd totally nailed it. And then he asked, you know, 47 questions that pointed out that we hadn't actually nailed it yet. And there's all these other things you had to control for and adjust for. And we ultimately were right that that first experiment did show the finding. But going through the steps to actually prove it for sure was one of those important points where you actually do really hard work and have to struggle. And that was a really important part of my development. And then subsequently, I spent some time working with Alan Garber, who is one of the greatest health economists. And again, I'd taken a bunch of data and you know, I thought I had discovered some epiphanies about labor productivity and hospital costs and quality and showed it to Alan. And he's like, no. and was able to unpack it and say, well, here's the, you know, the 47 other things one would need to do to be sure. And then learning how to do that and go back and say, and here it is. And then have him say, yeah, you're right.
So do you, that's an interesting skill set. I mean, there's not a lot of people that come to venture capital with that set of skills, actually. It's probably really useful, I must imagine. Or is it too much, since there's so much left to
I think, you know, I think I've been, my mentors have been good at helping me take intuition and translate it into real facts.
Okay.
And I think a lot of venture capitalists have great intuition, but they don't always connect the dots and cross the T's to sort of actually make sure they're right. Mm-hmm. But if you just use facts, well, you'd never make a decision because there's too much ambiguity. And so I think what I've been taught well is how to balance those two.
Did you think that you intended to practice medicine when you went to med school, or was it more of sort of like an analytic endeavor?
Oh, no. I thought I'd be my dream was to be a leukemia lymphoma doctor at Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center in Seattle. That was sort of plan A.
Wow.
I grew up in Seattle, and as an undergraduate, I worked at Fred Hutch as a patient family social worker, essentially, and was just taken by the patients and the tangibility of what they did and how beautiful it was when we could help them, and as well as how beautiful it was when we could help them live better with a disease we couldn't cure. And I had hoped to always go back and be a doctor, researcher there, and that had been my intention.
When did you get the sense that things might go differently?
Late in my residency, I actually had matched at Dana-Farber to go train in liquid oncology and had a mentor there, a wonderful doctor named Arnie Friedman, a person that is one of the best in the world at what he does. And I was, you know, all signed up to do that. But as I watched how we took care of the patients, I was just astonished by the fact that we didn't always do it right and that the system wasn't working as hard as I was to improve.
So what do you mean by right? What was going wrong?
What was an example of something that you
saw? I was always shocked that as the least experienced doctor in a hospital that U.S. News would rank, you know, 1, 2, or 3 every year, that I could make up the therapy. Didn't make sense to me that I could decide what antibiotic or what antihypertensive or what chemotherapy to give you or what dose. And the fact that I could order whatever tests I wanted and completely ruin the economics for the hospital, and in some cases harm the patients, in other cases maybe I was brilliant. But the idea that you'd have the lowest level, least trained person in the organization making these most critical decisions made no sense.
That's terrifying. That's really terrifying.
It's not how, you know, you don't have the youngest pilot fly the biggest plane. Right. It didn't make sense to me, and it didn't make sense that there weren't sort of a lot more controls. And we were taught at Harvard that, you know, every patient's a chance to learn. And while that's at one level inspiring, it seems bad for the patient.
This seems a little bit guinea pig-ish.
Yeah. And so, you know, while I so desperately wanted to be, you know, empathetic, compassionate, wonderful doctor, I was startled by the fact that there weren't more guidance. And while we had professors that would round, they really didn't know all the, you know, the 1,000 choices I made in between when you know, we connected on the patients. And that was always something that just stood out at me is that, well, I want to help patients be better, and I'd really like to treat cancer patients. But I began thinking that maybe I could help them more if I made the hospital work better for them, mm-hmm. because I felt like we actually had wonderful tools. I was at Dana-Farber when Rituxan was first introduced, mm-hmm. kind of in clinical practice, and we would watch GI stromal tumors just disappear. It was, you know, a miracle. But then we would still, you know, mess up the nausea, vomiting, pain, and infections and remit them. And so it didn't make sense that we couldn't sort of solve all the other stuff. And that's where I began to think about hospitals.
So is that why you left the practice of medicine?
Yeah, I was worried that if I just was a kind of a traditional academic doctor, that the system I'm working in wasn't going to be good enough to help the patients do as well as they could. And that we would spend all our time trying to optimize one part, but then we'd let, like, the 80%, which is the execution, mess it up.
That's a remarkably holistic view. Were there mentors you ran into that, that made you feel, hey, I see the world in a similar way? Or
were the doctors offended by that?
The doctors didn't understand me at all. I mean, they were like, why would you throw away this really promising Harvard career for something McKinsey would? But I remember I had this conversation with this gentleman named Jim Mongan, who at that time was running the Brigham and Women's and Partners Healthcare, who since passed away. And I walked into his office and I said, Jim, you know, hi, I'm Bob. I'm a fellow or a resident here at that time. And I said, why do you let us do it the way we do it? Like, you know, we could do better. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we had also recently overdosed the Boston Globe healthcare reporter. Right. And I was surprised that there weren't a whole lot more fixes to the system, right. You know, pokes that. And
well, I said, if you kill a reporter, then they can't report on it. So that's
a strategy. Lot of other reporters report on it. It's sort of a bad. It's bad. And he said, well, and I asked him, well, how can I get your job someday? Like, I think I could do this because I understand like what we do and I understand how to do it better. And after he wiped a very besmirched look off his face, he said, well, doctors don't know anything about how to run anything. You can't add. You don't understand how hospitals make money. You don't understand how to manage people. You're just a narcissistic, crazy resident. Like, you know, go away and get an MBA. I went home and told my wife I'm going to get an MBA. And after she decided not to actually harm me, she said that if I go to school another day, she would harm me. So I went back to Jim and I asked him, well, what's plan B? And he said, go to McKinsey. You have to learn business. Uh-huh. That hospitals, you know, care about patients, but they actually, you know, have to run. And you don't know how to do that.
So is it remarkable that someone can get trained up in a system through the point where you're sounds like a third-year resident, senior resident maybe, at with very well trained in a system, and you had virtually no exposure to any of the underlying economics?
It's not unusual. It's the norm. In fact, you can become a full professor of medicine and dean without having any sense of the economics, as is, you know, demonstrated by most of these hospitals.
It would seem like a fairly conspicuous gap.
It is. It's a gap in medical training.
Is it still?
Absolutely. So,
is it because people have trouble combining, on the one hand, that there's something, if you're thinking about the money, it seems that you're somehow diminishing the overall experience of being a physician, and that you're supposed to be that there's something intrinsically, whether it's corruptive or diminishing, about having the financial component that takes away from the underlying, you know, patient doctor skills that medicine has traditionally been about.
I think done wrong, yes, that would be a concern. I mean, medicine is an art and a science and a privilege and a profession where we get to help people. But part of helping them is to actually be efficient and productive and not wasteful and relentlessly high quality and caring about improvement and thinking about the patient experience and how to work as a team and even how to code right so you can actually finance the whole thing. And so I think that it's absolutely not at odds with world-class and exceptional care. In fact, I think it's a prerequisite for it, and it's a giant gap. Because doctors, when they think about quality improvement, they don't even know the tools. And so we could learn from Google and Apple and every other capitalistic company for how to improve, because they do it so much faster and so much better. And imagine if we had healthcare improving at the same rate as we improve every other product. Our healthcare wouldn't be one sigma. It would be like we'd be talking about the Six Sigma.
It's interesting. I was asked last week to talk about business models to a group of third-year residents over at UCSF. And it was like I was speaking another language. It was really interesting. And I mean, that was the point of it, obviously, was to educate them about stuff they didn't know. But the hunger for the information was palpable. I mean, you could tell they really wanted to understand. And these were doctors or, you know, almost doctors who wanted to be entrepreneurs in some way or had some entrepreneurial inkling. So, you know, for those doctors who want to be doctors, you know, how do you bridge that gap?
Well, one of my observations is when I now teach doctors about, Affordable Care Act and healthcare business and venture capital and McKinsey and things, is that a lot of doctors think the science is hard and the business is easy. And a lot of the business people think, well, the doctors are stupid and the science is easy. And it's, I think the first thing to do is have them understand that actually everything's hard. It's
and
really
they're all
hard.
Stupid.
Or that could be the other conclusion, but I don't think that that's right. I think that it's helping the doctors realize that it's really hard to have a hospital run on time and consistently deliver great care, or to get a outpatient with a disease to have their disease be well controlled, because you actually have to do a lot more than prescribe the medication to have these things work. Conversely, the business people need to understand that there's a lot of art to helping a patient be able to actually execute on that treatment. And we make it so complicated that, of course, it's hard to sort of deliver consistent outcomes. So it's having them both understand each other and having them understand who pays for what. And one way I do that is to help them think about, like, when you're a patient, like, how do you want it to happen? And then usually you can just point out in 5 minutes when you map out how it really happens, they see all the spots where it doesn't work right.
Are there any medical programs, I was thinking about this the other day, where they make the doctor be a patient?
I'm not aware of any that do that. As a med student, I remember volunteering to be a patient for money. So I would donate myself to research and be, you know, be admitted and have, you know, tests done on me. And so that was sort of a simulation. But that was a voluntary experience, not a requirement. And it was lucid. It was very important because when you're woken up at night every 4 hours for vital signs, even for 10 days, when you're healthy, it stinks.
Yeah.
Let alone when you're sick.
Yeah. No,
there's
kidding.
A tension though between trying to take the best care of the patient in front of you and then trying to think about the needs of the population. How do you think about that?
I think the first thing I think about is how to take care of the patient in front of you, because that's the person that is suffering right now that you need to care for. And I think about the better I can take care of this patient from a cost and quality and productivity experience perspective, the more patients I'll be able to help. So that's sort of the first way I think about it. The second way I think about it is making sure that in a world where we are going to have scarcity, whether it's talented doctors or beds or money, that we also prioritize correctly, that we help those who need it. And so there's an important population view to make sure that you're not neglecting people that actually would benefit.
So how did you get from this McKinsey hospital advisory work that you were doing, to the White House? How did that transition happen?
Serendipitously is the thematic thing from my career. It stemmed out of an observation which I had, which was when I came to McKinsey, McKinsey says to all new consultants, welcome to McKinsey, you're a generalist now. And I didn't sort of pay attention to that part in the recruiting. I didn't notice that was one of the descriptions of it. And so I arrived and said, hi, I'm Bob. I'm here to work on hospitals. And they said, really? And they said, well, that's not how it works. So you need to like learn everything. And I'm like, no. I want to do hospitals. That's what I came here for. I thought of it as like a fellowship in business, like my 2 years or whatever I was going to do. And so I said, I'll do hospitals anywhere on the earth. Just send me to a hospital. And so I spent the next 3 or 4 years traveling to 22 countries to work in hospitals around the world. Of all kinds, and in the U.S., academic ones, and for-profit ones, and not-for-profit ones, like all kinds of hospitals. Developing country world, a lot of the OECD, Singapore, Brazil, all kinds of places. And they all were badly run. You know, doctors had too much autonomy, there weren't many controls, the OR started late, patients were readmitted. And I was like, how in the world could every hospital on the earth be run so ineffectually? Are all CEOs stupid? And that was one hypothesis. But after thinking about it.
What was the experiment you ran to prove or disprove that?
I talked to a couple that seemed rather smart. And so I said, well, it can't be that management's just incompetent. It can't be like, you know, that all the good people on earth work at Comcast and United Airlines. Like that can't be it.
No, that's not the case.
And so it led me to the question of, well, it must be that they're actually optimizing around incentives. And the incentives must be wrong. That was it. And so I went to a woman, a brilliant woman named Deanna Farrell at McKinsey, who ran McKinsey Global Institute, who was, again, one of the most important people I've ever worked with from a mentoring and thinking perspective. She's a true genius. And I said, Deanna, we should study health system incentives and economics because they're got to be screwed up. And at that time, nobody was doing that. And I wasn't an economist, but nobody else had come up with the idea.
What year was that?
It's 2004 or so. And she said, sure, knock yourself out. And so I then took half my time at McKinsey and began building a team and doing basic healthcare economics. And believe it or not, in 2004, nobody had yet mapped either the incentives or where the money goes. So in 2005, we were spending roughly $2.55 trillion on healthcare in the U.S. And that was the top line number. And we kind of knew what we spent on hospitals and drugs, but we didn't really know where it went. And so we underwent the accounting task to figure out where does all the money go. And which, believe it or not, was the first time it had been done at a microeconomic level all the way through. And we then mapped out the incentives and the profits to show you, actually, everybody's profit maximizing in the system of incentives that we have. And so it's perfectly designed
for capitalism.
Economically, but it's not perfectly designed for outcomes or for, you know, population health, let's say. That was sort of what led me to policy, was we wrote this paper and it broke through. I mean, a lot of McKinsey papers sort of don't, but this one was one that was widely read and got me called by, you know, the academic thinkers on all sides of the political spectrum to talk to them about it. And it was also a chance to work with, it was the first time I worked with Zeke Emanuel. He was one of the peer reviewers along with Larry Summers and Peter Orszag and Alan Garber for this. And so I got to know a lot of those folks through this. But I went and briefed, I remember the McCain campaign and the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Obama campaign about the facts. And all of them cited this report as their kind of factual justification for their different healthcare policies.
Did you get to meet Sarah Palin? Did you debrief her as well?
I never got to meet Sarah Palin.
That's a damn disappointment.
Perhaps for you. And so that's, and so I briefed them all, and I think they realized that I had this perspective of doctor, mm-hmm. private sector understanding, and then a bunch of sort of fresh and empiric data on how the health system worked. And that led me to having Larry Summers ask me to join him at the NEC when Obama made him the chief economic advisor. And I remember him saying, well, since you've written the report, you know all the answers, so you can kind of knock this out in the transition, then we can get on with jobs and other stuff, which was Larry's sense of humor, in that he also, you know, had premonitions that may not be as easy as I thought it was at the time.
So about Larry, so my favorite quote was in Jonathan Bush's book. He has a really nice interview with, you know, Where Does It Hurt? He has a nice interview with you, where there's a quote that says, during the drafting of the ACA, you and Summers, quote, would sit down and we knew what the right answer was. We knew what the current answer was. We were 99% away from where we thought we should be, and we narrowed it to 80%. That was politically possible. And you say, oh, you lost some ground because of implementation. But the idea that you and Larry and presumably Zeke would believe that you knew the right answer would probably not surprise a lot of people. But I'm curious, what was the right answer?
Yeah, what did you not... What was the single most important thing you didn't get?
But first, what did you get? I want to know what you did get first. Like, you know, what was the key insight? It sounds like you have a vision of how things should be. I mean, that's an incredibly powerful statement there.
I think a lot of health economists and policy wonks, you know, you give us a whiteboard in an hour, we can draw out like a far more optimal system. And Zeke, Larry, and I, and Peter, you know, love doing that. And then you show it to somebody in the system today.
No, but what are some of the components
of that? And they'll tell you that you're out to lunch. I would say it's more degrees. So I feel like the Affordable Care Act actually gets at most of the ideas that, all the important ones that Zeke, Larry, Peter, and I had, and frankly that, you know, I think Jim Capretta and Joe Antos and Scott Gottlieb and Avik Roy have. I think that actually, if you put a bunch of us in a room, we would come up with something that's directionally very, very similar. It's about degrees. And we on the economic team really wanted more rapid risk-based reimbursement change. And we didn't care much if it was an ACO or a bundle payment or partial capitation or full capitation.
So in English, what would that mean? Like, what would what is
we
it
wanted doctors and patients to have a lot more incentive to be judicious in how they spend money. And we could absolutely give every patient enough money to get world-class care and outcomes, but we didn't want to waste money anymore. And so we really wanted to have the doctors and the patients be rewarded for making good decisions about how they consume money.
I thought what was so remarkable, because what it sounds like you're saying is that, I guess in the Stephen Brill book, that you guys were really on the side of pushing for much more market-based incentives, and then I guess there were other political forces that were pushing back against it, but that you and Zeke and Larry were actually really pushing. It's not necessarily the reputation the ACA has, but it was, you were coming at it from the perspective of strong market forces.
Doctors actually are really good at figuring out how to make money. And so if we change the economic incentives, the data from Medicare over the last 50 years shows that doctors in a few months figure out how to sort of adapt their practices. And so we felt like we could go quicker. It was actually largely large hospitals that didn't feel like they could go quicker. And then the worry that there will be some unethical behavior by some, and the inability for government or anybody, patients or payers, to figure out if doctors are cutting corners the wrong way.
But it sounds like you have one of the other things that comes across in listening to you talk in some of the interviews was it sounds like you have actually a lot more faith in doctors. And even though you say that they're sort of economically motivated and that's part of it, it sounds like you have more underlying faith in doctors doing the right thing than some others.
Oh, I think that I've not met a doctor ever who didn't want to do the right thing and who thinks they were. And I met many doctors who we would share data with and show them they may not be doing the right thing. And then they after they go through the initial denial and anger, they really rapidly change to be better. And so I think doctors actually, it's not just that they're competitive. I think they care a lot. That's why they're doctors. And if you give them ways to be better, they will. And I think one way to be better is to actually not pay them for activity, but to pay them for either an outcome or a total system of care, for collaboration with a patient, and even pay them to communicate better with patients so patients don't go home and be confused.
So as you walked away from that experience, what was your biggest regret? What was the thing you wish you had accomplished that you didn't get to?
Medical malpractice reform. Zeke and I did a bunch of work to come up with I think, very good proposals for how you'd modify medical malpractice. Mm-hmm. And the medical malpractice system today, from my perspective, doesn't work well. It's haphazard when it's applied. The patients who are harmed in many cases don't actually use it.
Right.
Doctors have this overwhelming terror that it's going to happen, that they're going to get sued. And so they carry it with them through every patient every day. And in some cases, they probably do duplicative and over-treat patients. And so it's one of those constraints we need to get rid of. And the great thing about medical malpractice is that doctors think of it as the giantest problem in their mind. And CBO says it's about a $54 billion issue. Mm-hmm. And so it's the amount of anger and angst that doctors have versus the actual cost of changing it makes it, I think, a no-brainer to fix it. And I was hopeful that we could get bipartisan cooperation to do it. The president, I think, was open to it. We had some good proposals, but it kind of died in the vine when it was clear that it wasn't going to be Republican support, because Democrats alone weren't going to do it.
So you went, it's interesting, you know, I think coming into this discussion, I thought, boy, how do you go from the policy side to the venture side? You know, it's such a big difference. But coming from the focus of economics, probably not so much. Was moving over to venture capital for you a culture shock, or was it straight up, you know, just a continuation of what you were doing?
It had never occurred to me to become a venture capitalist.
Yeah.
When I left the White House, I actually went back to McKinsey and began serving my old clients. And it wasn't as rewarding as I expected, because many of them were pissed off about this law and hoping it would go away. And I didn't want to work with people that were trying to repeal it, because I felt like, 50 million uninsured Americans and healthcare costs going at 5% and quality outcomes that, you know, we're not competing with Singapore yet, didn't make me happy. And so I actually very much considered going back into government. And then I had lunch with this guy named Todd Park, who's the most energetic, ebullient, and awesome government person I've ever seen, and the founder of Athena Health and Castlight. And Todd said, you know, Bob, you should go be a venture capitalist. And, you know, I'd never heard of a venture capitalist and never thought I wanted to be
one. That's disingenuous. That can't be true. You're at McKinsey. You've done all this stuff. You've never heard of venture capitalists.
The only venture capitalist I'd ever met was John Doerr, who at that time was, I think, head of the National Venture Capital Association, who was lobbying us for Energy Star when I was at the White House. I didn't know any venture capitalists. I mean, I'd never done it.
Well, I believe that. I don't think that most people are separated from the entrepreneurial world really have a clue about it at all.
And so, a lot of folks in healthcare at McKinsey seem to have discovered the VC world, nevertheless.
Most of my McKinsey friends who actually went into finance would go to private equity firms and do leverage buyouts. And that didn't appeal to me at all, because that didn't feel creative or disruptive to, you know, make healthcare better. But Todd's like, you should go do venture capital. And, you know, that seemed nutty to me. But Todd's, you know, a creative guy. And so Todd's like, no, really. And he called up this guy, Brian Roberts, who ran Venrock, and told Brian to hire
me.
He's
a legend.
And Brian, I'd never heard of Brian Roberts. And Brian, I think, loves Todd so much that Todd could say, you know, do anything, and Brian would probably do it. And so Brian's like, well, okay, I'll meet him. And I remember I met him, and we had a talk much like this. And then he said, well, why don't you try it out? And I had no idea what I was getting into. I've been surprised by the lack of data. So there's a lot of ambiguity in venture capital. And I've been surprised by how hard it is to find people who differentiate ideas about how to make healthcare better.
So what's the, not including investments you've made or Venrock's made, thinking outside of Venrock for a minute, what is the best idea you've seen lately? Like, what do you think, wow, that is brilliant. That really makes a difference.
I'm really impressed by what some of the capitated primary care groups are doing in terms of cost and quality. There's a company called ChinMed, which we discovered when I was at the White House, because they had the single best clinical outcomes of all the Medicare patients and costs that were like 40% below the market. And so we assumed it was fraud. And so we sent investigators down to visit them to see if, because they were in Miami, which is like the hotbed of craziness. And the Medicare investigators went to their office and then called us and said, oh no, this is like the best practice we've ever walked into. And so I said, really? So I went to visit, and it was. Mm-hmm. And they've since expanded into 13 markets and have, you know, take care of now several hundred thousand patients, and have replicated this model, which is more, you know, which makes Kaiser seem inefficient. I mean, it is far, far superior from a cost and quality perspective. And they use technology in all the ways that you'd hope. I mean, they do video visits, they do house calls, they give out the meds because giving out meds is a really cost-effective thing to do. They do all these things that you know you would imagine should happen in a place that actually is optimizing cost and quality.
And why can't that happen more places?
In most cases, it takes a really talented doctor who can do business. Because if you just do business, you don't know the clinical innovations. And if you're just a doctor, you get the cost structure wrong. And so these guys have really nailed both.
So is it, thinking broadly, you know, all the things you've done, can you have more impact on the healthcare system from the policy side or from the venture capital side?
I think it depends on the time. So I think at moments in time where you can change macroeconomic U.S. policy, you can have more impact from the policy side because changing them again, as we know post-Affordable Care Act, is really hard. So, you know, every decade or two, there's a chance to change a bunch of the important levers at the national level, and those will ripple through and have tremendous impact. In between, I think the way to have impact is to attack the incumbents. And the best way to do that is to create companies that are far more creative and far more fast-moving, and that will give the incumbents to move and change. And so now I think venture capital is the place to have impact.
There's so much interesting stuff here, and I feel like we've just barely, you know, gotten below the surface, and it's been an incredible opportunity to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to see you.
Thank you.